Welcome back to the Unbreakable Boundaries podcast with your host, myself, Jennifer Manili. Today's guest is a gentleman named James Brown. And this was an interesting conversation in that you're going to get to see an inside look as to what it is like trying to do podcasts in this remote world, especially when technology is not always your friend. And I know that we have all experienced at this point some technology challenges, as the majority of the world has gone remote in so many ways. And sometimes it's our friend, and sometimes you kind of want to throw the computer out the window. And this conversation, though, especially the first part of the conversation, it was so great. And I went back and forth. Was I going to use it? Was I not? But the conversation was great, and I didn't want to lose the first part of the conversation. So I did the best that I could in terms of cleaning it up. And about 20 minutes in, you're going to get to hear us transition over to another platform where it was a little bit more stable for us in terms of the technology realm. So one, I wanted to really thank you for bearing with our challenges. And sometimes it's just, we got to do what we got to do, and we got to work with what we got to work with. And the most important thing is that the content was so wonderful. And I want to thank my guest, James Brown, for bearing with the technology challenges. It's really hard as a guest, both as a guest and a host, really, when you are having technology challenges, to really dive in, because it was a little distracting, I think, for both of us. And yet it was still such a wonderful conversation, which, you know, is a testament to his message, and also a testament to what I am also putting out into this world in terms of really wanting to push forward and continue on with the great conversation, despite the technology challenges that we were experiencing at the time. And just know that, like I said, about 20 minutes in is when we transition from one platform to another. And I am so looking forward, at least in terms of the content, that I'm so looking forward to delivering this, because this was a really great podcast. And I don't want to lose the message that was brought to this, because this is going to help a lot of families. And it's going to help a lot of husbands, wives, parents, support people, friends, siblings, whatever. So please stick with us as we navigate through the world of technology. And here is our interview with James Brown. Welcome back to the Unbreakable Boundaries podcast with your host, myself, Jennifer Manili. I have with me a gentleman named James Brown, and I am very much looking forward to this conversation. It is going to be a very interesting one. Mostly because the very first place I really want to start is something that he sent in his bio. And I said, yes, that's where I want to start talking, is when he got stabbed by his ex-wife. So, James Brown, welcome to the podcast. And I would love to just hear a little bit more about that story.
Well, sure. Sure, sure. And thanks for having me. Well, okay, let's see. I got married in 2000. I had met her, you know, just from when chat rooms were still big. And we met in a chat room, an Alaskan chat room. And, but we were in, I was in Montana. And, you know, we met for a while. Decided we were going to meet, et cetera, et cetera. And one thing led to another, and she was moving to Montana to live with me. Ultimately, we got married. You know, one thing we both had in common that I love so much about her is that we both drank excessively. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would later find out that, well, I would later realize, I should say, that you know, I didn't marry her because I loved her. I married her because she drank more than I did. And it kind of took the focus off of me.
Right. So you kind of probably felt like, well, at least I'm not as bad as her. Probably made you feel more secure with yourself. Maybe not in the healthiest way, but at the time you're like, well, I must not have problems.
Well, exactly. It was more of a justification for me. Mm-hmm. You know, I could justify my drinking because at least I wasn't as bad as her.
Right.
And, you know, and it worked for a while. But that would ultimately be short lived. There were a series of issues when we were in Montana. And, you know, I won't get into all that right now, but, you know, we ultimately moved to Bend, Oregon, and, you know, she wanted to be close. So we moved Central Oregon, and you know, we had been married at this point just, you know, a year, a little over a year, and I was working for Mount Bachelor Ski Resort, and you know, I had stopped after work and had a few beers with the guys down at the lodge by the fireplace, you know, nothing crazy, and went home, and of course she was drunk. When I, and escalated, and she proceeded to tell me that, she was having an affair, which I knew, she was having an affair when we were in Montana. And, she had, been pregnant with twins and aborted them 3 months earlier. And I had no idea she was pregnant.
Oh, wow.
And that she wanted a divorce, and she picked up a chef's knife and stuck it in the back of my right or left shoulder.
So that's so interesting. So she's having an affair. She's telling you that she aborted twins, and she stabbed you literally in the back.
Literally, you know, literally stabs me in the back.
Wow. And I mean, what was her motivation? I don't know if you can answer that, but why did she do that at that moment?
You know, I'm not really sure. You know, I can't justify, you know, another alcoholic's reasons.
Right.
You know, she was prone to play the victim a lot in a lot of different situations, some being some childhood issues that, you know, she had experienced, you know, some being, you know, just the way she was. I had found out that when we met, or right before we had met, I was running a glacier cruise in Alaska for several years, and that you know, I thought that I was her husband. I found out that I was her fourth. Mm. Three of us were boat captains. One was nowhere to be found. He was kind of MIA, and you know, so she had a thing for boat captains. I don't know if it was because of the money that,
right.
You know, I didn't make that much money, but you know, I had done fairly well, and I had a history for whatever reason she had. You know, she, I mean, we were arguing. There's no question about it. You know, I had raised my voice. You know, I was never abusive to her, but you know, we were arguing, and I think that just maybe gave her an easy way out.
Wow. So do you think, and again, you may not be able to answer this, but do you think that when she stabbed you, was it just like, was her only motive just to kind of maybe physically harm you? Was she trying to kill you? Like, what do you think was going on?
I think it was almost, you know, almost impulsive. I don't know that she was trying to kill me per se.
Right.
But I think that she definitely to harm me. You know, right. I don't know if she felt threatened because of our, if she was scared in some way. I can't really answer that, but, I think it was an easy way for her to find a way out.
Right.
You know, and
yeah, I was going to ask,
go ahead.
No, I was just going to ask, so what did you tell other people what happened? I mean, obviously you probably had to go to the hospital. So what was that conversation like, telling people?
Here's the irony of this. And, in my book, I wrote about, I said that, you know, Stephen King can't make this stuff up. And, the night that this happened, I was arrested, and she was not. I was arrested, taken to the sheriff's department, and she stayed at the house. The arresting officer, follow me here. The arresting officer of the police officer that she was having an affair with in Montana.
Oh, lovely.
So, you know, I don't know if that happened. You know, I don't know if, you know, I mean, I was oblivious. You know, I was working and then I'd get home and I was drinking. You know, I mean, that's what I did.
Right.
So I didn't pay attention necessarily to a lot of the details or maybe some of the things that she had done that led up to this. She'd been in contact with this person at one point. You know, I'm not really sure. But, you know, I would find that out later during our court time. I had ultimately, because of what had happened, the neighbors heard us arguing and had called the police because they heard something about Kimmy yelling that I was going to stab her or something like that, which it was actually her saying, I'm going to stab you. So they called the police. Well, you know, I was arrested with a knife wound and, you know, a pair of jeans. And that was it. And, you know, they found the shirt that it went through, the blade went through. And it's just very weird series of events because the shirt came up missing during trial. And, you know, we ultimately decided we were going to try to work things out. It's what alcoholics do. And, and you know, I took a plea agreement that would allow me to be released if I agreed to a misdemeanor domestic violence charge, which I did do. I agreed to that. And when we went to court, not only didn't accept the deal, she gave me a, I think they called it at the time, an upper departure, and changed the misdemeanor charge to a felony and sentenced me to 30 months in.
Oh, snap. You're right. Stephen King can't make this shit up. And these are the types of situations that we just find ourselves in when there's like substance abuse going on. And so what I'm saying is that we find ourselves in really messed up situations in our lives that it really is like, how do we get into this stuff? How do we like find ourselves? It's just like a bunch of chaos. Sometimes we have to be held responsible for the decisions. And sometimes it's like just chaos that should not be happening really is happening. You got stabbed. And you're the one that ends up getting arrested. You're the one that ends up with the felony. You're the one, you know, it's like, these are the types of things that do end up happening, which can sometimes legitimately make us feel like the world is out to get us. So did you have that sense?
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
I did. And that's when I started thinking about, you know, writing my book. And, you know, the original title, I was going to call it, instead of The Lines on My Face, I was going to call it Modern Day Job, because of the sufferings that Job from the Bible had experienced. And, you know, I really felt like, you know, the world was out to get me. I think it started years prior, but, you know, at that point, it was almost like a concrete proof.
You're like, well, I have all this evidence to back up that the world is actually trying to get me. Like, why me?
Right. And, you know, I think about it and I think, you know, I pondered for years why, you know, is it the world that was just out to get me, or really kind of what was my involvement in it? And, you know, the bottom line is I just lost sight of myself. Yeah. You know, I just lost sight of it.
Yeah. And it's like, sometimes we do find ourselves in situations that it does seem like, yes, it's not our fault. And yet when we're not really grounded and connected to ourselves as people that are in that world of substance abuse, we can't actually find ourselves. It's like it is almost like the universe is telling us that we need to change the course of our lives, that weird things are going to keep happening that sometimes we have to take responsibility for. And sometimes these weird chaotic situations simply just keep happening because we're not necessarily in alignment with where we're supposed to be in our lives. It's almost like the universe is trying to get us back in the right course. Now, you had mentioned, you know, prior to hitting the record button that was a situation in which kind of started your thinking about getting back into recovery. Now, was this, because I noticed, I know that you had 12 years and you relapsed. Was this part of that relapse that you had, or was this in the more current, this is what got you to get back sober now?
This was my, you know, very first honest attempt at sobriety. You know, it was you know, I was sentenced to 30 months, but I only did 10 at a treatment facility for substance abuse. It was my first I think attempt at truly becoming sober. And you know, and that lasted, you know, a couple months. And you know, I ultimately decided I was going to go back to Alaska, where I, you know, I picked up a DUI, and ended up doing 19 months in an Alaskan prison. No fun. But that was, that period there was when I had, solid foundation, in sobriety. And continued. That would have been in 2007 and stayed sober until almost 2019.
So you had 12 years. What was first as a part of that recovery, when you first got into recovery, what were some of the challenges that you really struggled with, as part of that particular?
Well, I think that, you know, some of the struggles that I faced were, I don't even want to say faced, because I certainly don't want to sound like a victim.
Right.
You know, some of the things that, you know, I really had to take a look at is, how do I repair the past? How do I repair the relationships that I had ruined over the past, you know, years that, you know, I don't think I realized were so important to me until, you know, I didn't have to drink to numb everything. That was the biggest struggle for me. That and having to take a deep, you know, hard look at my, you know, my role in things, you know, my actions on things. You know, I always go back to, you know, my ex-wife, and, you know, truth be told, I just wasn't, you know, I wasn't a mean husband. I wasn't, you know, an abusive husband. I just wasn't a good husband. I didn't focus on her, you know, the way I should have, regardless of her issues, regardless of her addiction, abuse issues. It's not the point. You know, the point is what, you know, what role did I have in it? How somebody else reacts in response to things is really none of my business.
Right.
My role in it is. And that was hard for me.
Yeah. It's so important to start really looking at some of those things and taking that ownership over what we're doing in our lives. You know, we don't have to take all ownership of everything, but we do have to take our parts in it. And sometimes that's really hard. It's really hard to see our parts. I don't know. I don't care how long I have clean. I think it's part of being human, not so much being, you know, whether you're in recovery or not. I think that's just kind of part of being human, is taking responsibility for our parts in situations. And you had 12 years, and it seems like you were doing good. Now, during that 12 years that you did have, and you said you were active in recovery, did you find yourself in these like weird chaotic situations anymore?
Yes, I did, but not necessarily because of my doing, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
Weird chaotic things happen. Difference is that, you know, I had learned how to deal with them without drinking. I was dating a girl that long story short, her parents were rafting a river in Montana and their boat capsized, and her father made it to shore, but her mom didn't. And so he called. We took off to Montana and we joined the search and rescue team. And, you know, we looked for weeks, and, you know, we had never found her. And, you know, life goes on, you know, life happens. Yeah. Ultimately, she would be found, 8 weeks later, 38 miles downriver.
Wow.
And, you know, her mother was found in Montana, you know, making a funeral. You know, life continues. Crazy things continue to happen. But, you know, being in a sober network, you know, working a variety, you know, I had the ability to say, but to get not drinking.
Right. As I said in the beginning, we began to have overwhelming technical issues in this episode. The content is so good, and I didn't really want anyone to miss what we were saying. He kind of ended with saying that he had the tools to actually get through some of these chaotic situations and not drink through them, which is part of what we learn and part of just kind of being in this world and life. And then we change platforms since we were having so many technical difficulties. We did change platforms and continue the conversation. So if you've been listening this far and you've been bearing with some of our challenges, I thank you. And we will kind of attempt to pick up where we left off, even though it wasn't a perfect transition, but thank you for bearing with us, and we will continue on in this conversation. One of the things that I really wanted to kind of hone in on was that you had 12 years in recovery, and I think for a lot of families out there, they make this assumption that once you have, you know, 12 or however much time, you get some time under your belt and you're just good. Like nothing could ever derail you. You're living a good life. And I think, you know, both you and I know that that's not always necessarily the case in terms of that we're still as susceptible of going back into that place if we don't continue taking care of ourselves. So what were some of the things going on around that relapse for you? The mindset shifts? Was there an event that happened that brought you into changing the direction of your recovery? So tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think that, first I just want to say that, you know, we hear sometimes in recovery that, relapse is part of recovery. And I don't agree with that. You know, I think that relapse is part of addiction.
Yeah, I agree with that.
You know, it happens to be part of my story. But it's not part of everybody's story. But, you know, what happened for me was I really stopped. You know, I almost reached a point where I thought I was healed. You know, I was I was okay. I was fixed, you know, kind of like, you know, a lot of families do. You know, I mean, you know, they think that, okay, you've got 3 years, 4 years, 6 months, whatever it is, you know, 12 years, you should be good. You know, my brother, you know, would always make comments like that to me. You know, well, you know, I mean, you've been so long without, can't you just have a drink? No, I can't.
Yeah.
And, you know, but I had stopped in 2011, before moving to North Carolina, I had met a woman that, we started dating and, you know, I told her I didn't drink. I didn't tell her I was an alcoholic and that I was in recovery.
Right.
You know, I just told her I didn't drink. And that was the start of my relapse, you know, because I wasn't being honest about it. You know, I wasn't working a program like I should be doing. You know, I wasn't going to as many meetings as I should. But when we moved down here, there were two things that really, I think, led to, you know, my actually picking up a drink. There were some relationship issues, you know, some distrust and things that were happening, but ultimately, my relapse happened because of, pain issues. I was experiencing a lot of pain in my lower back and my knee. You know, I would take, you know, pain medication. I was never a huge fan of it. It didn't seem to do a whole lot for me.
Right.
But I could pick up a pint of whiskey and drink it and everything would be numb. I wouldn't feel it. And that's what ultimately led to my going back is the pain and, you know, not wanting to rely on, you know, other types of medication. Alcohol was readily available and I knew it worked. You know, I was just relying on things that, you know, I relied on my whole life to numb everything, you know, like I numbed growing up.
Well, and physical pain as well as emotional and spiritual pain can often resemble, you know, us feeling a little hopeless ourselves to where it's like, I have to change the way that I feel, whether it's physical pain or emotional pain, it's, I have to get out of this. And sometimes if it's long enough and we don't find a way out, that is a lot of times what can bring us back into our mindset shift, starting to change and thinking that this becomes a solution for us, something that we know is going to work to take this pain away. And
exactly.
And it can be really hard to feel just so powerless against our own bodies, you know, and that may be a mental thing. It may be a physical thing. It may be an emotional thing. But at some point, we do start to begin to feel like we're hopeless. I have felt, you know, so much emotional pain to the point where it was like in my recovery with years clean going, what am I going to do? How, like, I cannot keep feeling like this. Something has to change.
Yeah. And, exactly.
And, yeah. And so I think that we do end up not making excuses. And I love that you very quickly made that distinction between when we say like, oh, relapse is a part of recovery. And we don't state that clearly for others out there where it's like, no. It is. You're right. It's a part of addiction. It's not a part of recovery. And we also have to learn how to, and this is why sometimes, you know, we will say things like that, is we want to ensure people feel safe that it's like, okay, it happens. And now what are you going to do about it? We don't want to make excuses for you, but let's put the baseball bat down and just say, how are you going to do things differently now that it's happened? Don't feed yourself into so much shame that you can't begin your recovery and healing journey because you're beating yourself up over the relapse. Like, we got to move on. Like, okay, you did it. Like, let's move on and figure out what you're going to do to help yourself. But it is not a part of recovery. It is a part of addiction. Yes. And it does happen. And I have, like, relapse is a part of my journey as well. And a lot of it was that emotional pain that I was talking about. Mm-hmm. I relapsed. I had to get out of whatever it was that I was feeling. And I don't think that I had enough tools in my toolbox mm-hmm. to handle what I was going through at the time, because I didn't stay in recovery. I decided to get back into my addiction mindset. That's what happened first and foremost. So,
well, it's what we know. Yeah. And it's what worked for us in the past. At least it's what our minds thought worked for us.
Right. You know. Well, and we'll tell us that it'll work this time. Mm-hmm. Like, we say these things in our brain of going, well, I have some time clean. It's not going to, like, I kind of know what to do now
yeah.
and what not to do now. Like, I know where the line is, right? Like, I know where to not go, but you know what? We don't. We'll think that, and then we'll start going down that road. And as soon as the substances start hitting our brain again, it starts rewiring back into a lot of that old thinking that we had worked and spent so much time healing. And it'll just snap right back.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, you're absolutely right. I thought that, you know, I had enough knowledge that it would be okay for me to drink to numb the pain, the physical pain I was having. And yes, there was emotional pain because there was some, you know, abandonment issues, which I have abandonment issues, but
surprise,
well, go figure, right? And you know, but there was some of that, but the physical pain, you know, and I thought that, okay, I've got these surgeries coming. I'm gonna, you know, it's going to be better. You know, I could drink until it's all done, and then I can be sober again. You know, and that was, you know, that thought process that it was okay worked until I got pulled over one night.
Right.
Yeah. And then here I am with the DUI, you know, so, you know, I could just see that old habit, the old pattern starting, you know?
Yeah. And this is always, I try to remind families that it's like, well, there's the like logic of someone who is healthy and someone who is thinking clearly and someone who isn't part of substance abuse, like doesn't have substance abuse. And then there's like addict logic, and they're mm-hmm. two very different things.
Completely different.
and, but it's logical to the addict. But it's not always very clear to the rest of the world of like, how does our thought processes make sense? Right.
Right.
And this is where the families really struggle, especially people that don't understand the addict logic. So I guess my question or point is what was some of your addict logic when you were in that relapse, telling yourself that things were different, things were okay, you're drinking and driving. And that's, you know, obviously that's bad in all of itself, but it made sense at the time. Right. So what were you telling yourself? Like, what were some of those voices going on in your head?
You know, I mean, you know, if I could try to, you know, decipher some of the voices, you know, I mean, it ranged everything from it's okay because it's going to be short lived. You know, I'm not going to, I know how to be sober.
Right.
You know, I'm only using this to, you know, I'm justifying it to say it's okay because it's just getting rid of the pain. And at least I'm not taking pain medication.
Right.
You know, my getting behind the wheel of a car, you know, I can justify that by saying, you know, I'm only going around the block or yeah. I'm just going to the store, which was probably to get another beer. You know, I also, you know, I also justified it by saying, it's okay. Nobody's going to know.
Mm, yeah. Yeah. If nobody knows, then it's not actually happening.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
so this is something that I have been spending a lot of time thinking about, you know, even recently when I look around is going, but people put on a great front in front of other people, because yeah. if nobody really knows the inner workings of what's really going on, then that means it's not really happening. And that is like addict logic to the T, right? It's like, exactly. Well, I'm not really shooting heroin or cocaine or drinking too much or whatever, because nobody knows about it.
Right. I mean, I would go to an AA meeting and then go pick up a drink afterwards.
Right.
And that's okay, because I was at a meeting.
But nobody knew, and you were being productive towards your recovery and nobody knew about it. So it was fine. You were... Right. being healthy, you were living the recovery lifestyle, and you were balancing it out, you know, really well.
Sure. Yeah.
And I'm being sarcastic. If I'm sure that, you know, people couldn't tell that, but I'm being sarcastic, but that's the addict logic or the alcoholic logic, right?
Right. Exactly.
However you want to, whatever label you want to put on that, that's how our brains think.
Yeah.
When we're in it, it doesn't have to make sense to the rest of the world, because it doesn't make sense.
No,
but
not at all.
It does make sense to us at the time. Like, right. Yeah, well, of course.
Yeah.
You know,
it's okay. I went to a meeting, so yeah, okay. You know, I'm hurt and I can have a drink.
Yeah. For when I was in my relapse, and I was like shooting heroin and cocaine, and I was doing it with other people that I had met in recovery. And we would spend time talking about how we needed to get our lives back together. We needed to go to meetings. We needed, like, we talked about the recovery tools. We talked, like, and so because I felt like we were talking about doing those things, it must mean that we weren't actually really that bad.
Right.
Yeah. Right. It's like, oh no, we're going to detox and then we're going to start going back to meet. Like, we're going to do all of these things. And we like pump each other up and then we would just sit there and get high together. Right. Mm-hmm. But we couldn't be that bad off if that's what we were talking about while we were getting high. So, yeah. You know, it was cool. It wasn't, I wasn't that bad.
No. And then I would have, you know, a friend, you know, neighbor come over, and, you know, he would, you know, bring over, you know, some beers, and, you know, I would justify saying it's okay to drink because at least I'm home and I'm not driving.
Mm.
So it's okay. You know, I'm not out, you know, terrorizing anybody. I'm not out causing problems or drama or drinking and driving. You know, I'm sitting right at home. I can drink.
Yeah. Well, what's wrong with that? And they're sitting at home and drinking. Well, really, there isn't anything wrong specifically with that. You know, plenty of people sit at home and drink. And yet it does something different to us. And there's a lot of, like, you know, patterns, behaviors, and mindsets. And it's more the mindset that comes with it that becomes the challenge. It's not the substance. Yes, the substance abuse is bad, but it's that those behaviors, it's the patterns, it's that mindset shifts that we have that are so destructive.
Exactly.
And that's where, you know, we can find ourselves in our own deep, deep denial about our substance abuse, because the substances aren't always our problem. Yeah. They, they don't help with our thinking very clearly. We right. do stupid shit. We do unhealthy things. We get in unhealthy, toxic relationships. We get stabbed by ex-wives.
Yeah. An ex-girlfriend burns your house down.
Or ex-girlfriend burns a house down. Oh, let's talk about that while we're here. Since you brought it up, that's an interesting place to go. So let's go there.
You know, I can't prove it.
Oh, okay. Okay?
But I owned a home in Central Ohio. And, you know, I was dating this girl. She had kind of been staying with me a little bit. We'd been dating for a while. But she was a partier, you know, and she would go on these little MIA trips for, you know, 4 or 5 days and find her, I don't know, a few days later, she'd call or come back to the house. She was at some rock concert. And I mean, just, you know, just blatant disregard for any common decency for somebody that you're dating.
Right.
And, you know, she had, she brought her stereo over to the house, and it was one of those big old Kenwood style, you know, the big box stereos. Mm. And anyway, long story short, it was a couple of days before Christmas. And, you know, I had a dog. I was upstairs sleeping and you know, my dog woke me up, and, you know, which was unlike her. So I was taking her to the top of the stairs. I was going to send her back downstairs, and I noticed the smoke in the, you know, about halfway up the stairwell. So I go down and check it out, and the whole back of my house is completely engulfed. Mm. Yeah, I got the dog out, you know, and like I said, you know, Stephen King can't make this stuff up. I tried to get out the front door, and I had forgotten that I recently changed the locks on the door, and I did something to it so the front door wouldn't open.
Mm.
And of course, you know, I'm trying to open the door and it won't open, so I ended up having to break a window to get the dog out and get myself out. But, you know, it was a complete loss. I think the only thing I was able to save was, you know, a green pillowcase and a few other things. Mm. But what's interesting, and why I say the girlfriend burned your house down, is because, you know, the fire department had gone through the back of the house. There were sliding glass doors, the patio. And behind the house, it was a condo unit. There was a row of, I don't know, they were probably 8-10 foot shrubs that separated other units. And, you know, the following morning, I'm out there and I notice a bunch of CDs were kind of dropped sporadically behind on the other side of the shrub. And they were heading towards the road. It almost appeared as though they were dropped as somebody was running.
Interesting.
And, you know, I still hadn't seen this girl for a couple of days. And she called me. We had agreed to meet at the burned down condo. And she started asking about her share of the insurance money. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Your share of, well, you know, am I going to get any of the insurance money? No. Why would you?
Right. Yeah.
You know, well, I had some stuff here too. I'm like, well, yeah, you had a stereo and some clothes, you know, but the insurance money is going to cover the cost of the condo, not
your stuff,
your stereo.
Yeah.
You know, so it was just, you know, they determined that the cause of the fire was electrical. They said it started simultaneously 3 different places of the house. But it just seems to me that it's just a little ironic that her CDs were spread on the backside of this 10-foot shrub, you know, leading towards a roadway. It was just weird.
That's an interesting situation. And, you know, we hear things like that. And for us who are used to these kinds of things, you know, I can sit here and laugh about it. Right. Because it's funny. It's like, yes, at the time, no, it wasn't funny. It was whatever. But it's like the craziness that our lives are sometimes is astounding. And I will, I'll be talking to like clients of mine. They're usually parents, and they'll be telling me these like really crazy stories. And yes, they'll start kind of going like, oh my God, I can't believe this. And then we end up like just cracking up over what is going on, because there's no sense. It's like the insanity that is involved with us is you have to laugh at it. Like, and I think that sometimes when we look at these situations and we don't laugh at it, it can really eat us up. It can, and it doesn't really serve us. So it's like, sometimes you just got to laugh at what you're hearing. Like, my whole life has a lot to do with people in recovery, and I got some crazy stories, and it's like, you just got to laugh at the craziness that seems to just follow us sometimes. Not so much now. Like, I don't have too many crazy things going on now. I really enjoy listening to other people's crazy and living vicariously through their drama. That's not mine, but it is. And it's like having these kinds of stories, you know, you got stabbed by an ex-wife, you had an ex-girlfriend burn your house down, and whatever other chaos you have. Do you have any other? You wrote a book on this stuff, and you had mentioned it was chaotic. So what is something else that came up that was just like, how do I find myself in this situation?
I mean, it's like, I could just pick, any.
pick a normal Friday night.
I was, my best friend, we actually met in Alaska. And of course I was still using at the time, but he was an old rodeo clown from Southern Arizona. And, he was your typical cowboy, the black Stetson hat, the skull can imprint in the back pocket, tight Wrangler jeans, a little goatee mustache. Women loved him. Women loved him. I don't know why. He's just a skinny little thing. Kind of reminded me of Barney Fife. And, but women loved him. And, he and I were inseparable for a lot of years. I mean, he is closer to me than my own twin brother. And I was always finding myself in something with him. And we found each other. We found ourselves Southern Arizona, San Pedro River. Never runs, but there was a lot of rain, a lot of runoff that year, and. He gets this idea. Let's go float to San Pedro. All right. Let's go. And, but we didn't have a boat. So we went to his friend, his name is, we called him Fat Man, for obvious reasons, but, went to Fat Man's house, and he said Fat Man had a boat. I'm like, all right, cool. Well, Fat Man comes around the corner carrying a 6.5-foot styrofoam sailboat. But he didn't have the oars for it.
Well, of course not.
I said, Roger, we're not going to be able to, how are we going to do this? He's like, well, there's a couple shovels. We'll take the shovels. We got a surfboard that, we can attach to the back of the sailboat. Two of us can be on the sailboat and one on the surfboard. And so we're like, okay, fine. It's 10 o'clock in the morning, 11 o'clock. We're drinking already. And we get on the San Pedro, and this thing is gushing. I mean, it is just gushing like nothing I've ever seen. And, and I had spent some time on the water. So we get on this thing. Roger's sister was going to meet us a couple miles downstream and pick us up. Estimated it'd be 3 hours, 3.5 hours that it would take us to get there. But we got on this thing. We're using, shovels for oars. Roger's got a 12-pack of Coors beer. Fat Man's on the surfboard, and Roger and I in the boat. And we turn this little bend. We're not even on the water for, 10 minutes, 15 minutes, and we capsize. And the only thing that, I hear is Roger yelling, "Get the beer, get the beer." Of course, save the beer. Forget us.
Save the beer.
Right. So we're sitting here bobbing on this. We lost the oars, lost the shovels. We're bobbing on this this river, holding on to a piece of styrofoam. And we're going down this river, and there are fallen trees. There are rocks. brush piles. We could have died. I mean, we're hitting our heads on everything. We're going through brush, under trees, over trees, over logs. We lost Chris. We found him. He popped up out of the water, I don't know, 50 feet or, 30 yards. I forget what it was, down river from us, but you could just see the blood pouring off his head. And, we were on this water doing this for 6 hours, 7 hours.
Oh, wow.
And there was a point where I was caught upside down underwater, and I had old hiking boots on, and the shoestrings had gotten caught on a limb. And I finally grabbed this limb or this log, and I was able to pull myself up, but it wasn't a log. It was Roger, and he was stuck underwater as well. I mean, we're inhaling all this muddy gunk and this water coming through here. And I really thought that we were going to die. And we finally made it to shore, made it to a shoreline. We're soaked. Sun's going down. It's cold in southern Arizona desert. It gets cold. We have no beer, no oars, no working lighters. But we were able to find a set of railroad tracks. So we knew that if we took that, if we followed that, we would eventually find, a road. Right. So we followed that for a couple hours until we found a road. During that time, I was almost bit by a, 4.5-5 foot diamondback rattlesnake. we made it to this roadway, and here comes this little old lady in a pickup truck. And, the three of us are soaked, freezing, bloodied, bruised. She wouldn't let us in the cab with her, but she took us into town. We were still a few miles outside of Sierra Vista, Arizona. And, she took us into town, and, where we met up with, his sister. She brought us a fifth of Jack Daniels, and it started again.
Yeah. And it was like, well, that's worthy of a drink.
Yeah, exactly. So we dug a hole in his driveway, in the gravel driveway, and built a fire pit and just started a fire. So
yeah,
that just makes craziness.
That's craziness. And so sometimes, things just start getting really out of hand. And now you had 12 years, you relapsed and things got bad and all that. And then you finally, what was kind of the turning points of that to kind of get you back into recovery?
Well, I had a total right knee replacement. I had three spinal laminectomies. I had a lumbar fusion and an SI joint fusion. And, that's what ultimately why I drank to numb the pain. And, but my turning point was, I woke up one morning, in my bed. I was laying in my own vomit, and, two of my dogs are laying there beside me looking at me like, are you going to live, Dad? And that was it for me. I don't have children. My dogs are my life. And, to wake up like that, that was my point. Like, I am not going to do this, for me, for them, for my significant other at the time, I'm just not going to do this. I can't.
Yeah. And so what would you say, when you finally made that decision, you were like, I got to do something different. What was it like the first week?
It's when you quit, it's different for everybody. I never really had like withdrawal symptoms or anything like that. What I had was the mental anguish of, I just lost my best friend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I lost what I've relied on my entire life. Even, you know, I mean, I'm taken away, you know, I mean, I'm not even, well, I guess I do think about that 12 years because, you know, I just had different outlook, different means of dealing with it then. You know, here, you know, it's like I skipped all that. I started drinking again and I had skipped that 12-year period and went back to what I relied on. You know, and when you give that up, it's like, you know, here you are again, you're alone. I felt that loneliness, that that turmoil of, you know, knowing that my support is no longer there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it was more that mental anguish for me versus physical withdrawals.
And this is something that I think is, because I don't think the families really quite understand what it means to, obviously we need to do it and we got to start the recovery journey somewhere. Otherwise our lives just never get better. We end up in, you know, worse off in so many ways. We may, you know, spend the rest of our lives in jail. We may have to go be locked up into a psych ward, whatever it is. They don't quite understand the struggle and what it is of what it means to actually take our, what you said, like our best friend away from us, you know, and the grieving process that comes along with putting the drugs down, putting the alcohol down, you know? Right. And 'cause it's like, oh, you should just be happy that you're not smoking crack anymore. It's like, yeah, yes, I don't want to smoke crack anymore. And I'm still really struggling with not having the thing that I've been using to make myself feel better. And now I actually have to deal with this. And I've dug myself into such a deep hole of shame and despair. And now I don't even have anything to cope with it. And when we first start out, we don't have all of the tools that we gain later on. We develop them. Mm-hmm. We work through them. And so to that point is what do you think is the thing that really supported you in sticking with your commitment to yourself?
You know, I think it was, you know, there was a point where all I ever wanted in my life was for, you know, my parents to say that they were proud of me.
Mm.
You know, that's the only thing I really ever wanted. And when I had had that sobriety, I heard that one time, you know, and you know, I'm, you know, I just turned 51 years old and, you know, I've heard one time in my life that they were proud of me. And, knowing that, you know, I lost what, you know, I was going through that emotional, you know, feelings of, you know, grief of not having that anymore, that support of drinking. You know, I knew that if I kept going, if I kept doing what I needed to do, then I could make somebody proud again.
Mm.
You know, I could get that feeling back. You know, I wrote a goodbye letter to alcohol.
Mm.
You know, my best friend, you know, my crutch. And I said goodbye. You know, it was a breakup letter to you know, my alcohol. And you know, and I knew that, you know, if I kept that goodbye going, if I kept that thought process, that I would, or you could and would at some point make somebody proud again.
Yeah.
You know, and that really is what, you know, kept me going in the beginning. You know, it ultimately turned to, you know, making myself proud again.
Right.
You know, because, you know, at the end of the day, you know, we don't do this for other people. You know, we do this for us.
Yeah.
Other people are, of course, affected. You know, they were affected in our use. So, you know, they're going to be affected. You know, the woman I've been with the last 10 years, oddly enough, here we are. We separated last year primarily because of my drinking, you know, and the weird thing is we still live in the same house.
Right.
That's another story.
Whole nother. Oh, we don't have time for that. No,
but it's, you know, but it works, you know, it's working. Okay. You know, but I'll go to my meetings and, you know, she's like, you've been sober. You know, why do you still need to go to so many meetings? You know, she just doesn't understand. Yeah. It is what keeps my mind focused.
Well, yeah. And, you know, that's part of like what the most important thing is for people to understand is we have to absorb our minds into a different way of thinking than what comes natural for us, because left to my own devices, my thinking goes into really, even now, if it left to my own devices in a lot of ways, left to them for too long, my thinking can go to some interesting places. My addict logic will start coming back, or my alcoholic logic will start coming back, and I'll start thinking things are, it's like start rationalizing things and justifying things and all that. And I need to be reminded, especially in the beginning, like in the beginning of my recovery, because my brain hadn't healed itself, it was still chemically trying to solve itself, right? It was just trying to repair itself. The emotions were all over the place. It takes a while for those things to heal and balance out. It's not, oh, you go to 30-day rehab and you get out and all of a sudden everything is magically fixed. Both physically, right, mentally, emotionally, all of those things. No, we have a lot of healing and it takes a long time. And even now it's like, you know, I'll still go to my recovery meetings, and sometimes like some people don't really understand why. And I'm like, it's just the community. It's just it's just taking action as a part of my recovery that is important to continue that healing growth that I have developed. It's also a way to be able to give back at this point, you know, share wisdom and insights, because that's how we do it. It's about supporting other people too. Mm-hmm. So it's so important of like, I think for the families, and a lot of people will say this, that are in recovery, is like the families could do a lot to just by learning themselves. Yeah. You don't have to ever, like, you don't have to necessarily experience it to be able to empathize.
Right. Exactly.
And it's like, you don't even have to understand it. To this day, my mom doesn't perfectly understand my recovery life. It's not hers. That's what, it's not hers to own. She's just like, okay, just do whatever you got to do. So, and I think that's good for you just be like, this is what I need to do for myself. Mm-hmm. So to that point, I want to ask you, and this is before I get into my final question, I actually want to talk a little bit about your book, because you had mentioned a couple of times that you wrote a book, you wrote an autobiography, because Stephen King cannot make this shit up. It's called, it's called The Lines on My Face, right? And where can people get it if they want to hear more about your crazy adventures and what you wrote in that?
It's available on Amazon.
Okay.
Amazon.com. You can just, you know, Google in The Lines on My Face. You know, I do have a Facebook page, The Lines on My Face, and there is a link there that will take you to the Amazon page.
Great.
But it is, like I said, it's just, you know, I'm not a huge supporter of, you know, as we call them, war stories, you know, when you're in meetings and such, you know. I think there's a time and a place for that. This book, you know, just talks about my life. You know, that some may interpret as war stories. It's just what alcohol did in my life.
Yeah.
And you know, why and how, you know, I got sober. Now, this book was written during my long-term sobriety, or started I finished it, and I'm actually working on a second that will, you know, discuss more detail of relapse and getting mm-hmm. sober again. So that is coming, but it is available on Amazon. You know, there's some cool stories in there, some funny things, you know, some bad things, but
sure.
You know, addicts and alcoholics, you know, we understand. Yeah, I mean, there are people out there with worse stuff than I've ever seen or done.
Oh yeah.
So
absolutely. And I think it's important because it's like you said, like when we talk about war stories and what we mean by that for the people that aren't, you know, in this is like we go deep into the feelings of using what we used. We'll start comparing stories, and it's not of service when we are in that community to do that with each other. It brings up a lot of feelings and it's painful. But what I have found very interesting because, you know, I'm actually writing a book myself right now. This is my second book. And from you writing it is I have found that what it really does serve is the families out there of getting to hear what really goes on, and it's being of service. It's not necessarily a war story as much as it's like educating the families out there on what was going on, what were our mindsets, what was the situation we were putting ourselves in, and it's because I had to kind of break free a little bit for myself of the recovery norms that were kind of taught in order to go in here, because I was like, man, I really feel like I need to dive in to support the families out there, but this is really hard. But I've done a lot of healing through the writing for myself, through those stories of really diving deep into what was going on with me. I have found it to be really cathartic. I don't always support necessarily recovery people in reading it because it goes really, really deep into some of those things. But I do support other people because it's so beneficial. And I feel like for you, in a lot of ways, that those pieces of writing, I don't want to put words into your mouth, but I imagine it was probably very healing for you.
It was. I mean, you know, the best way to take the power away from something is to talk about it.
Oh yeah.
And, you know, there are ultimately two things I wanted to do with this book. You know, I wanted to talk about it to release the power. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wanted to write this in hopes that, you know, one person somewhere out there could get something from my story in my life. If one person got something out of it, then everything that I went through was worthwhile.
Yeah.
You know, it really took a lot of soul searching. You know, you receive a lot of insight, you know, when you write something like that. I mean, you know, for all these years, I didn't know that my problem was myself.
Yeah.
You know, I thought that my problem was women and alcohol.
Yeah.
The problem was me.
Yeah. And that's something, you know, I do see a lot of like the families out there, they really struggle with, and even for us, like for me, I really struggled with the idea that the problem was me. It wasn't anything else, but it was me. And that took a long time for me to accept and to see, because I really did believe that even for myself, oh, well, if I just stop doing these things, everything's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. Or if I get this person out of my life, or if I move, how many times did I move trying to get a fresh start? And the biggest problem was that I was carrying my baggage with me. That took me with me. Right. And so it's like the same shit just kept happening over and over and over again. I would find all of the same people. They had different faces. They had different names. And I'd find all the same people. I was dating all the same people, you know? And it's like, even from the outside, people were like, oh, you need to get rid of that person. You need to get rid of that person. And it's all their fault. And we can easily get sucked into that to our own sets of denial about, oh, it's so much easier to blame that person for all of your things. But it's like, right. No. I'm dating the same people. Mm-hmm. You know, they just have different faces and names.
Right.
And all the same shit.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I wondered why, you know, I just thought it was interesting that every person I ever dated, you know, liked to party. You know, how coincidental is that? You know?
Yeah. But,
you know, how true is it that I search those people out?
Yeah.
You know, because of a level of comfort for me. And something I didn't tell you that, you know, I do want to share with you real fast is that, the power of forgiveness, you know, in sobriety is huge.
Yeah.
I received a call. It was last fall. Well, it started with a Facebook friend request from my ex-wife.
Oh.
The one that. You know,
the one that stabbed you.
Right. Okay. And I was reluctant at first, but I accepted her friend request. And, you know, we chatted a little bit on, you know, through Messenger and all that stuff. And, a week ago, 10 days ago, she called me.
Wow.
And we talked for about 45 minutes. Mm. And, you know, it was, you know, we talked about, you know, one of her family members being on life support because of an alcohol overdose, and how they expected that he was going to make it another maybe 3 days. And, you know, this kid's, you know, 35 years old. And, but, you know, I had to forgive her at some point. You know, I could not carry that around with me, you know. You know, I've never seen her since that night. You know, I just, you know, carrying that baggage with me, you know, I was never going to heal unless I was willing to forgive her.
Yeah.
And I did. And here 16, 17 years later, you know, we talked for 45 minutes on the phone. It was a very civil conversation, you know?
Right.
So it's just, you know, it's a lot of soul digging.
It is
so many realms.
And I'm so glad that you brought that up because of, you know, I know that forgiveness is a whole lot more about me than it is about the other person necessarily. And nor does it mean that I will accept those kinds of behaviors in my life. And I think this is where people falter, especially like the families out there, because their loved ones are doing so many messed up things to them, and they really are. Like, and it's hard to think about possibly forgiving that person because they're like, oh, I'm never going to forgive them for this. And it's like, no, well, forgiveness is a whole lot more about letting that go for you, not for the other person. And it doesn't mean that you're forgiving so that you allow them back in your life to do the same things over and over again. Right.
Exactly.
Like, that's not what that means. So, but you're right. It's such a road of healing to go down.
Right.
And
I mean, forgiveness is a choice.
Yeah.
It is a personal choice, you know, but you're right. It doesn't mean that we're saying, okay, I forgive that situation. I forgive that instance, come back in and do it again.
Yeah.
You know, it is a conscious choice that you make. So you don't have to carry all that, you know, that wonder, that guilt, that remorse, that shame. You don't have to carry that with you. It is an absolute 100% choice.
Yeah. And that comes with really learning how, one, you know, to set strong boundaries and be confident in the boundaries you're setting, because when you can do that, you can actually forgive people and not allow those behaviors into your life anymore for you. You know, you can heal that part that was allowing these behaviors in your life in the first place. And then we can move on, and it's a great and wonderful thing. And that's one of the things that, you know, I work with so many people on is like, I know that you are angry and you're going to have to let it go and forgive.
Right. Exactly.
You know, and that's a hard place to be, but it is. I mean, but it's so important. But you're right, where it's like the power of recovery and forgiveness, and also just the power of being human and forgiving each other.
Yeah.
You know, people have a lot of big traumas in recovery, mm-hmm. and we have to learn how to forgive the harm that people have done to us too.
Right. Absolutely. You know, I mean, the harm that, people have done to us and the harm that we've done to them.
Yeah.
You know, because we have, and that's, you know, I can't think of the harm that, you know, I mean, I don't, at the, you know, we can look at the harm that we've caused our families, you know, but, you know, we're going to look at it an entirely different point of view, you know, so mm-hmm. we can't truly understand, you know, what our families are thinking,
our
families are going through, you know, because we're going to look at it at our selfish side of things.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did it, but it really wasn't that bad.
Yeah.
It was.
No. Yeah. It was that bad. Mm-hmm. And it takes a while for us in recovery. And again, I'm so glad you brought that up. It takes a while for us in recovery to actually be able to see the other side of it, because we don't know what we put our families through. We weren't experiencing it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like when we would go missing, they were left not knowing what the hell was going on. They're sitting there going, is this person dead? We don't know what that was like for them, because to us, we weren't missing because we knew exactly where we were, mm-hmm. you know, right. and the families, they're the ones that are being left with all of the questions, the angst, the sleepless nights. And it's like, mm-hmm. we are very self-centered in that way. It takes Absolutely. A while for us to start recognizing and seeing it takes a lot of healing. And then it's like, oh, now we're actually starting to think about other people.
Right.
You know, and that takes a few years clean, to be honest with you. I mean, some of the things we can get pretty quickly, mm-hmm. but to really start being able to empathize with other people and to dive deep into seeing things from the other points of view, it takes a while.
It really does. And, you know, I think that that's, you know, I think that's an important thing to acknowledge is, you know, that true sobriety where you make that solid connection. I mean, the opposite of addiction is connection.
Yeah.
And, you know, until, you know, I mean, even in early recovery, you know, especially in early recovery, I mean, your shit's all over the place. Oh my God. He said, she said, he said, you know, drama, 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 you know, and that's to be expected. That's going to happen. You know, but it's going to take some time, just like you said, it could take several years before you truly make that solid, honest connection with another human being, you know, and yourself, for you to truly understand who you are, you know, what your values are, what your morals are, what your boundaries are. You know, I know that I am absolutely great at setting boundaries. I'm just not so good at maintaining them.
Defending them, right? You know? Would be so great at setting, not so great at defending.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and that's something. Yeah. And that's, you know, I have, obviously this is called the unbreakable boundaries for a reason, is because of how important really actually making those boundaries that you uphold, you know, and how important it is to not only just set those boundaries, but actually make them so that people don't break them.
Right.
They can't break your boundaries. Like if you're really committed, and it's like, how do we do that? How do we ensure? And it's not to say we're not seeking perfection here. Right. Sometimes we falter. Like I falter in my own boundaries. Like I'm saying, I have the unbreakable boundaries. I have a program that I teach boundaries and all of this stuff. This is what mm-hmm. I work on with the families. And yet I'm not seeking perfection even from myself in this. There are times where it's like, oh, I actually went against one of my own boundaries. Oops. Mm-hmm. Let's get back on track.
Right. So. Well, with, you know, like with Erica here, you know, now, you know, even though we're not together, we're in the same house, and, you know, oddly enough, we kind of get along better now than we did over the last few years, know, but when I got, you know, when I get sober, you know, I wanted her to go to a meeting with me. I wanted her to understand,
yeah,
you know, what it was like. You know, she said she has absolutely no desire to do it. She wants nothing to do with my sobriety. You know, I said, okay, that's fine. You know, you don't have to, you know, just don't try to interfere with my sobriety.
Right.
You know, the only thing I ask is that, you know, if I want to go to a meeting, I go to a meeting.
Yeah.
You know, if I want to do a Zoom meeting, I do a Zoom meeting. You know, take the dogs outside, take care of the dogs, keep them quiet, whatever the case is. But don't try to impact that in a manner that's going to take me away from it.
Yeah.
You know, I won't push it on you. Don't try to take it away from me.
Yeah.
You know, it's the only thing I can ask, you know, and I think that she, and I think that that's important for families to understand is, you know, we can't expect you to do anything. We cause so much harm and damage, you know, that, you know, it is not right for us to ask anything from you. But I think if given, you know, given some time, I think that she will see the difference, you know, and she will start to understand.
Yeah, that's exactly right. We change. And I believe in the power of recovery and in our abilities to change when we're really committed to it.
Right.
And how I've seen some miraculous turnarounds in people, you know, and I one of the worst things that I feel like I can personally do to someone is put them in a box and leave them in their past if they're really committed to changing and if they really have changed. If I'm seeing a person the same way I did 10 years ago, even though they've changed dramatically, but I still see them through that lens, that's doing such a disservice to them.
Absolutely.
and all of the work that they've been able to accomplish. And so, you know, I always give people the right to change. And that's, I think, is really important. And that's something that I remind families is like, give them the freedom and the right to change and show you that they are going to do it. It takes some time and it takes some effort and, you know, it takes some empathy and takes some understanding. And you're right. We don't have the right to ask anything else. And I will also say that it is also hugely important to the health of the relationship. If you want to maintain a healthy relationship, and you want to heal that relationship, that being a part, not necessarily going to meetings with them, but being a part of their recovery is important.
Yeah.
Educating yourself about, you know, what you can do just to help and support and all that. It's important for the healing and growth of that relationship. So it's like, yeah, you don't have to, and you're making a choice, and that's okay. It's okay that that's your choice.
Right.
And that relationship will have a hard time healing and growing. That just is.
Yeah. You know,
so,
I mean, you know, relationships, and not just romantic relationships, but, you know, personal family relationships, you know, the thing is that, you know, how often and how long have we heard, you know, relationships are, you know, 50-50, you know, I don't agree with that. I think relationships are 100 and 100.
Yeah.
You know, if you are only given half of yourself, you know, half the effort that you have in a relationship, you know, it's not going to work. You have to give everything that you have within a relationship. If you're going to make it work, if you don't want to make it work, that's fine.
Yeah.
You know, but if you want to make a relationship work, you know, you have to be able to give 100% of everything that you have.
Yeah. I always, and I do, like, I am so grateful. And I say this a lot about to my mom, because she did get help for herself, but it was help for herself. It wasn't necessarily direct help for me and for my sake. It was for her sake. She did it for her.
Right.
And that gave us the ability when I was ready to do my own work, she did her own work, and then we did our work together. And, you know, like, there was a couple of times I begged her, I really wanted her to go to meetings. I wanted her to, like, be a part of my recovery. And there was a couple of times she totally went, And I really appreciated it. And she wanted nothing to do with it at the same time. And that was okay. She did go anyway, because I asked her to do it. I could tell that it made her really uncomfortable. She never said anything. And then it was like, you know, it's my recovery. And I really appreciate that she did truly make an effort. And if I asked her today, I was like, can you please go to this meeting with me? Like, please, like, I really need you to be there. She would show up in an instant.
Yeah.
Not wanting to be there. And she would do it.
Exactly.
But I don't ask her that of that. I just don't ask her to do those things, you know? And we have a really great relationship. And I'm grateful for that.
Absolutely.
So I know we've spent the last, you know, little while talking about the families, but I always just like to specifically ask the last question of what do you think that the families can do to best support themselves?
You know, I think that, you know, I think the first and foremost, you need patience. You know, I think you need, you know, if you have the patience and you have the willingness, it's going to take time. Yeah. You know, it is going, you know, it took us a lifetime to destroy our relationship with our families and friends.
Yeah.
You know, we're not going to heal it overnight. You know, we want to, but I think that, you know, I think by trying to do so, we're only going to injure it more.
Yeah.
You know, if we, you know, to the families, you know, it's going to take some time to gain that trust and that respect and that admiration, and that belief, of us, you know, don't rule anything out, you know, you can trust from a distance.
Yeah.
And that's okay. You know, we kind of expect that.
Yeah.
But for a person getting sober, you know, we are not victims. I mean, we may be victims of certain circumstances, but we're not victims of our actions. You know, we are the cause of them.
Yeah.
But it is not easy for a person to get sober, whether it be alcohol, you know, heroin, cocaine, whatever the case is, you know, it is a life-changing, soul-searching, self-seeking experience that we want to share with our family, but we also know that the reluctance is there.
Yeah.
The only thing I would ever ask of my family is don't give up.
Yeah.
You know, I always refer to an old proverb that says, hope deferred makes the heart sick, but a longing fulfilled is a tree of life.
Mm.
And, you know, when you you lose that hope, you know, what else do you have?
You know,
maintain that hope, maintain that strength and that belief that we will achieve and regain that relationship, and it will be a tree of life.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that a lot. I really appreciate you sharing that. And I'm sure the families out there appreciate. And I just want to thank you so much for coming on this podcast and sharing yourself with my audience. You know, this is not an easy thing to do, to put ourselves out there like this, but I'm really grateful that you did. So thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I'm glad you had me on. It's truly been a joy. And, you know, it helps me, you know, it helps me. I hope somebody, you know, can gain something, or, you know, just wants to hear some more crazy shit, and, whatever it is.
I think there's a power in for the families that feel like, oh, am I the only one that's dealing with this like crazy thing? Mm-hmm. And this is kind of right in par with how it looks, right? people are crazy. Well, thanks again. And I'm looking forward to keeping in touch. And thank you out there for listening to this podcast. If you want to listen to more or find more information out about this podcast and more of what I do to help families, you can go check out my page at unbreakableboundariespodcast.com. It's full of other great podcasts just like this one and other great resources to look through, as well as it's going to have the link to his book in the show notes. So I invite you to go check out that, The Lines on My Face. I love that title. And please remember to share this podcast with others. You never know who may need to hear this. People are often hiding their battles in this arena, and sharing is a great way to provide this valuable resource to a person you may not even know needs it. And don't forget, there is always hope, even when things seem the most hopeless.